Hello everyone, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And we are historians.
And if this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians and other victims of the research bug.
We're going to talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And once again, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this?
We'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which Eve and I are presently enjoying occupancy in what we call Melbourne today. That is, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, whose land was stolen and whose sovereignty was never ceded.
Today on Archive Fever, we're speaking to historian and filmmaker Samia Khatun, who is currently a senior lecturer at the School of Oriental and African Studies within the University of London. Samia was born in Bangladesh, educated in Sydney, and has worked in Berlin, Dunedin, New York, and Melbourne. Her first book, Australianama, is a history of the South Asian diaspora in Australia that uses the perspectives of the colonised to transform the way we view the past. As Samia puts it, the book challenges the claim that the knowledge traditions of enlightened man have superseded the epistemologies of peoples colonised by European empires. First published in 2019, Australianama has been heralded as a game-changing intervention in historical thinking. It won the Scholarly Nonfiction Book of the Year in the Educational Publishing Awards Australia and was shortlisted for the Douglas Stewart Prize for Nonfiction, the Multicultural New South Wales Prize and the Ernest Scott Prize for History. Welcome to Archive Fever, Samia.
Thank you for having me. Very good to be here.
We'll talk more about Australianama in a moment, but first I'd like to go back to where your Archive Fever began. Did your fascination with research and archives start with your history studies at the University of Sydney, or does it date back even earlier?
I thought it started with studying history at the University of Sydney, but it turns out that it's actually about the family. It's actually about being the carrier of lots and lots of different oral archives that have long been in the family. So you always tell these stories about where it begins, depending on who you're talking to. But yeah, today I think it began with the family.
And what kind of oral archives in your family sparked this interest in archives?
So there was always this way in which the stories that I was hearing in the family, so tales about dreams and prophecies, tales about marriages and, you know, illicit romances, there was this way in which none of those ever found a place in the history classroom in Australia. It was that kind of disjuncture where the most incredible epics that I was hearing at home just have no space. And so trying to bring those in to the classroom is what sort of made me aware that, oh my God, there's actually this archive that I'm obsessed with. And I guess history, the history classroom, gives you that language of archives to be able to get at this world that you know is incredible, but no one's giving life to in public life in Australia.
Samia, your book Australianama begins with an extraordinary archival discovery, a book of Bengali poetry in a mosque located in the outback town of Broken Hill in New South Wales. Can you tell us how you first came across this book and why did this one book lead you to write Australianama?
So I saw an image of that text in Christine Stevens' Tin Mosques and Garn Towns, and I guess like many first-generation migrants, I was doing this really big task of ignoring my own world, I guess because you're ashamed of it a bit. And so everything I wrote up until that point had nothing to do with South Asia at all. But I kept going back to this one book, Tin Mosques and Garn Towns. You know, just saw this just really captivating image that I could even from a distance tell. I don't think that that's in Arabic or Arabi. I think that's in Bengali. I don't know what's going on there. I'm going to go look at this text in the middle of Australia. And I think I got a bus from Sydney and you go to the city council and say to them, I'm Muslim and I want a key, because then I can pray in the mosque, and they give you the key. And yeah, it was just such an extraordinary, extraordinary find and an extraordinary moment. I can't describe what it was like to actually just open up that text and realize it wasn't a Quran. First thing I did was, of course, call my mother and say, Mother, I found this thing. You will never believe it. And, you know, I read her like one or two lines and she knew exactly what it was absolutely immediately. She was just, you're supposed to perform this. This is a performance that you've just started. And it turned out she was right.
And did you know then there was going to be a decade of your life spent kind of researching questions that came out of that book?
I didn't know at the time that it was going to be something that would obsess me in quite the same way that it did. What was going on in the background was Mum was very ill, and it became this very strange place to have Archive Fever. It sort of it had a pull to it where I could just obsess about past characters who had in some sort of previous world and previous life lived in Australia, and it allowed me to in many ways mitigate some of those worries I had about, you know, Mum was passing away. She was very slowly and painfully dying, and I was just sort of like, the obsession about it, I still can't quite make sense of. I'm sure that someone outside of me can much easier go, yeah, this is what you were doing. I felt like I could spend years and years and years and years and years looking for who could read this book and who could understand this book. And I was in a fever. That is actually the right word to describe what happened.
And Samia, does that fever have physical effects for you? Is it an embodied experience for you, being bitten by the archive bug?
It's the kind of experience where I can wake up in the middle of the night and start trawling through things I've scanned, looking for people. You know, it's the kind of thing where at any moment in time, you're half there. You're half trying to solve that problem. You might be sitting there having a conversation about what's going on today, but actually you're thinking, in 1892, did Sher Khan really come from Kabul, or did he come from Calcutta? And so it's this sort of, it becomes this everyday part of your thinking, and you can sort of spend every single moment obsessing about it, and you don't quite know why, but you know you've got to see the logic through to its end. That's the feeling.
And among many things, Australian Armour is a devastating critique of the monolingualism of Australian history. Even though this continent's always been home to many languages, as you point out, its history's mainly been written using English language archives. In your view, what have been the effects of this monolingualism, and why does it need to shift?
One of the effects of this monolingualism, I think, has been to silence or subdue the various other planes on which meaning-making is actually happening in Australia. And I use the word silence in particular because I think that the monolingualism has meant that we are actually only able to engage with knowledge traditions that are in print form. The vast world of oral and oral knowledges that actually completely structure knowing on the Australian landmass, on Australian lands, on Aboriginal lands, has become not actually something that we can access or even understand, even if we were to hear it. And I don't think it's specific to Australia. In Australia, the monolingualism has a particular effect of sort of stifling the other sets of knowledges going on. But I have to say that now that I live in Britain, I can also see, being on Aboriginal land, the fact that you're thinking from Aboriginal land is an incredible, incredible, incredible resource that you just simply don't have here in London. There are ways in Australia you can get past the monolingualism in all these different ways by getting out onto country with Aboriginal people. In London, you don't even have that. So, yeah, the monolingualism's had a very big effect, but I think we are lucky in Australia.
One of the elements of your book that I loved so much is that there's actually a strand of memoir that runs through it. I mean, you weave your own research journey across the Australian desert into the storytelling. Can you tell us a bit more about how being on country changed your point of view? And I just would like to read one line that really struck me. You say, "At Anna Creek Pastoral Station, I caught glimpses of the various Arabunna women whom I had only ever read about. When Reg pointed out where Beralda had given birth to his mother Amy, I began to grasp something of the intimate lived significance of the places we were travelling through." Can you expand a bit more on that? It's beautiful writing and very evocative of place.
It was extraordinary being on country with Reg. It's not the first time, of course, that I've been on country with Aboriginal families, Aboriginal people. But this sense of this vast land that is Arabunna geography, Arabunna lands, that is, you know, the size of Belgium, as people will tell you. The realization that for him, every single corner was as densely storied and well known as the inside of my home. So what I might think about my little balcony, or what I might think about the window that I sit on to sing, or what I might think about in my family home in Taka, about the place where my mother fed me as a child, these are memories that are completely inscribed across this geography for Reg and for many people like him who have this incredible inscribed memory into land. So once you start glimpsing that, there's sort of no going back to seeing the land as empty in any way. There's no going back to seeing the land as unstoried in any way, a blank slate in any way. And it completely transforms how you even orient yourself in the space. You could inherit these memories. You could have these memories of people's past actually transmitted to you and told to you. And it's alive. It's intimate. Under a tree can be an intimate place where someone gave birth.
Samya, you trained as a historian at the University of Sydney, which was the first university in the Australian colonies, and now work at SOAS, which was founded as a training ground for colonial administrators. But much of your work has been dedicated to sort of unpicking colonial ways of thinking and knowing. In other words, you're kind of critiquing the very institutions, the knowledge institutions that have trained and employed you. So I'm interested in what it's been like to do that work from within. Can you tell us about the sort of the intellectual and the emotional journey of being what you could sort of say is a Trojan horse in the university?
The university is a difficult place from which to be writing the kinds of things and stories that I do. And at the same time, it's precisely the place that's sustained and given life to these other ways of thinking that in some ways I've been recuperating and finding. In the case of the University of Sydney, I always think of it in terms of when those founders put that first slab of stone into Gadigal lands, it was an assertion of the superiority of Western knowledge systems. Yet it's right there under that land as you're standing on it. The university can give you tools to be able to hear and access those things. So it's not an easy space to occupy in a sense, but the university always has had a function where if you are able to go and find something that it does not know and bring it into the middle of it, you're rewarded for it. And so I guess that's in some ways how the paradigm of modernity works, to be able to take things and be able to bring something in. That's what's considered original work. Mm-hmm. So it both punishes you for doing something that's completely outside its rules, but then it also rewards you at the same time. So I've had to learn how to play that game. And I guess I'm learning how to play that game in London now, which, as you pointed out, SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies, it's set up to train imperial officers. And it's one of these spaces where, as African, Middle Eastern and Asian countries start decolonizing, basically the global South elites come and take it over. Well, take it over is probably too strong, but you get all the anti-colonial nationalists coming in through SOAS and training. So it becomes this strange hodgepodge place that's actually about empire, that's actually about holding up empire, but at the same time it has the highest concentration of people with a critique of empire. And one of the ways that I've been trying to draw the connection between what it was like being in an Australian university and what it's like here is, in some ways, every single text that is in the SOAS library is kind of like that text that I found out in Broken Hill. It's sort of sitting there and for a very long time has been read as a dead text. And literally each one of those texts in the library here at SOAS, you could pick up. And if you approached it as an alive thing, as a thing that is actually political theory, as actually can shape human subjectivity, it has the capacity to actually completely transform what we even understand human consciousness to be. And I guess that's a very, very, very exciting thing to try and do in a classroom that has so many people from so many different parts of the world converging upon it. But it's not easy.
It is exciting, but as you say, it's also a challenge. And this is one of the things I think your book does, is that it throws out a challenge, not just to the institution, but to the people who work in the institutions, for example, us historians. And what you really do is stress the importance of asking different questions of the archive. It's the questions we ask. It's not the archive itself that's at issue. It's how we approach the archive. And as you show, the questions we ask shape the stories we end up telling. And we can only tell new stories if we begin with different questions. So, for instance, you asked that question, could the poetry collection in Broken Hill have been brought there by a woman? Now, conventional wisdom held that South Asian women didn't travel to Australia, but your new question led you to discover that this was a lie, that women, in fact, did travel across the Indian Ocean and in significant numbers. So when it comes to asking different questions of the archive, is this the process best achieved by having different kinds of people in charge? In other words, do we need to challenge the whiteness of the history profession? Or do white historians need to challenge their own biases to start asking those different questions? Or both?
It's absolutely about the kinds of questions people ask the archive. It's also about the kinds of questions that generate the archive itself, I think, because it's that set of questions about who bought this book here. That's not a question that anybody else, I think, would have got quite so obsessed about and spent 7 years trawling the archives in search of an answer for. So in some ways, that is very much about me. That's about someone who is trying to make sense of their place in Australia from this kind of sort of at the margins space. And I think that only someone who is asking that question for the sake of constructing themselves or having some sense of becoming whole through asking that question could ask it for 8 years and generate that archive. So very much I think you need different kinds of people in the profession. And we know that history remains one of those spaces that it's actually very, very, very difficult to get people from non-English speaking backgrounds, often because they're first generation migrants and job prospects are utterly terrible. There's a host of reasons that means that it remains incredibly, incredibly white. At the same time, that being able to ask questions that nobody else is asking, that is also definitely the responsibility of the historians who are already inside the institution. And I think that, you know, that particular incredible moment when I realized that, wow, as soon as you start looking for women in the archives, you find women in the archives. That's, I guess, an old realization that many, many feminist historians have had before me, you know, for decades now. What you look for is what you find. Now, one of the things that was incredible in training me how to ask questions in this project was realizing that if you basically used faith, if you used the metaphors of faith that this text gave you, because the text told me, if you tie your lungi or your loincloth to your waist, believe in Allah and jump into this archive, this oceanic archive, you will find pearl after pearl after pearl after pearl. So there was this incredible calmness and beauty to actually submit to the logic that this book, that is very much not a secular history, this faith that actually I have to submit to the logic of the book in order to see through where it takes me. That is something that I think is a big challenge to white historians in Australia. Could white historians in Australia do something like that? I'm not sure that I could pick up a text from Navajo traditions and be able to enter it in that kind of intimate way. So I don't know. I guess I wait to see in new generations of historians and new work to see whether that's something that people could do from an outsider perspective as well as an insider one.
What I really love about your book, Samia, is that, you know, on the one hand, it's about South Asians in Australia, but it's also about so much more. It's about these bigger questions of the politics of how we know, the kind of temporalities we invoke to make sense of the past. And in your introduction, you show how in the 19th century, history and historians were so complicit in the imperial project. They created the narratives of progress and modernity that enabled imperial expansion and, you know, racist hierarchies of people. I'm interested in how the role of historians has evolved. You know, if historians were once agents of empire, how do you understand the role of historians today? Like, what do you think is our social and political function in the 21st century?
So I think the modern historian is completely and utterly married to the nation state. That's something that we can see happening in the 19th century and emerging in the 19th century, but it would be denying the incredible richness of what has happened to the historical discipline, I guess, as the British Empire has collapsed and as post-colonial theory, as all sorts of other thinking has actually been picked up by historians. I still think that the historian is the midwife of modernity because I think the historian works on time, and the very concept of how time works and how modern time works and what it means to make a radical departure from that which is not modern, that imagination is something that historians are at the absolute forefront of doing every single day. Our job at the end of the day is to time travel, is to take people to the past. And in taking people to the past, what we're actually doing is we're making them travel along a temporal index. That's the real work that we're doing, because whatever temporal index we take them to the past along, that's the particular line of travel that they can see going forward into the future. So I see the historian as having a very, very, very crucial role to play in actually being able to articulate and define what the lines are along which we imaginatively travel. Now, here I sound like I'm being quite fanciful, but you know, you mentioned that the historian creates the progress narrative, creates the tale of civilization that we're moving towards. Now, if the historian invents progress or institutionalizes progress as the main way of thinking about time, then the historian also has in their hands the power to think of other ways of traveling through time, other ways of imagining hope and what a better future or an imagined better future might look like. So I guess I have perhaps grand understandings of what a historian actually does. But I guess as a historian, we've seen that this is the role that we've played in the past. And so it's our role to undo it and also come up with new pathways forward.
So on that idea of finding other ways of travelling through time, one of the things that your book features heavily is dreams, and you've already touched on this right at the very beginning, but you describe vivid dreams that your mother has, as well as your own, and you suggest that, and I'm quoting here, the dream archive illuminates a pathway to the libraries whose ruins belie colonized geographies. So where does this interest in dreams come from, and what do you think the dream archive can tell us that other archives can't? And I suppose when you use that phrase before, that oceanic archive, it also prompted me to think, is this dreamlike approach Freudian or Jungian, or is it germane to non-European epistemology?
So Gloria Anzaldúa has this wonderful quote about dreams being a wonderful entry point that sidestep the fictions of white superiority. And that's how I used them in the process of writing the book. But also there's lots that's not in the book that I used in terms of there's lots and lots of family stories about dreams and dream interpretations. And it was only because I know that those are an incredible part of Muslim South Asian experience or just Muslim experience, I was able to look out for dreams as they were published in Australian newspapers about Gallipoli, etc., by South Asians. One of the really fascinating things that has emerged as I've thought more and more about this, and my next project's going to definitely go in much greater detail into this, is the way in which it's actually a completely different trajectory of thinking about dreams to the Jungian or the Freudian mode of thinking about dreams. And what's important, if we start thinking in that way, is about Freud's theorization of the unconscious. So in his body of work, his theorization of the human subject as having this entire section that is the unconscious, that particular theorization of human subjectivity, if you think of it as one way of actually understanding and experiencing human interiority, then you can actually start seeing the various different trajectories and histories and intellectual histories of engagements with dreaming. One of the things I never quite understood, and I still don't really have an answer for, is it's very well known in Muslim intellectual history or Muslim cultural history that dreams are a big, very, very, very important thing. So why is it that in Aboriginal Australia, that entire cosmology, that entire complex world of thinking is then encapsulated by this term dreaming? There's a way in which the dream becomes the name for that which is subjugated knowledges in modernity. So I find it an incredibly, incredibly rich entry point into not just ongoing experiences of other interiorities apart from modern subjectivity, but also literally you can approach your dream as an archive. I'm having dreams like my mother, like my grandfather, like everybody. I have dreams that are literally just sections of texts. And because I'm a cultural historian, I can now go and find them. But that's probably for another podcast. That's the next book.
I would like to ask one more question about your next project, which I believe is an effort to decolonize the temporality of history writing. What would a decolonized history look like? And can we do that history in colonial archives, which are obviously structured around linear time and colonial logics, or do we need to be engaging with different archives altogether?
In the next project, I'm turning to the late 18th century because I'm actually really going to look at that moment where Enlightenment thought, Enlightenment as a mode of seeing becomes how time is structured in modern consciousness. You know, like I think that this question of what it actually means to decolonize history, what it actually means to decolonize scholarship, for me currently, it's about time or it's about progress. It's about the narrative of progress. And I can't get away from the narrative of progress because it's what organises racial logics, but it's also what organises hope. It's about decolonising how we think about time and hope and better futures. And my argument would be that you have to start being able to use times and temporalities that other peoples still continue to inhabit. And by other peoples, I mean non-moderns. It's a racial category, this non-moderns, but it's also very much one of these things that no educational institution today is set up to teach you how to actually inhabit, cultivate, and piece together those modes of subjectivity that haven't gone away. Mm-hmm. They're right there. Modernity just tells us that they are dead. So for me, that's what decolonizing history or decolonizing knowledge as a larger project is about, is actually about rejecting that claim that those modes of being are dead. And, you know, I think that this question of does it need new archives or can you do it in colonial archives, I really do think it's about an orientation to the archive. I mean, the answer is both. There's all sorts of different archives that we could be using. I just talked about dreams as an archive, as a library that you could think about that exists within you. But I think that in colonial archives, what's important is the questions that you ask of it, the particular things that you're looking for in the archive. If you go into a colonial archive for the purposes of recuperating a mode of being and living that has been declared dead or made to be dead, that's precisely what you're going to be able to piece together. So I think it's about asking the right questions inside the colonial archives, because it's actually not about saying I'm going to ignore colonial archives or I'm going to ignore modern history as a tool or as a paradigm. It's about harnessing those things and using them to do this other thing, which is about making live that which has been made to die.
We're going to have to sadly wrap it up now. It's been such a joy to talk today, Samia. It's just been a dream for us. Eve is nodding their head wildly. Thanks to Samia for coming along today. Don't forget that you can catch up on all of Season 1 and 2 via the website archivefeverpod.com. You can learn more about Samia's work via her SOAS profile, and you can follow her on Twitter at Samia Khatun. Until our next therapeutic session, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees. And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded and produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri land.
Our theme music is by Poddington Bear, and you can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
And you can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright.
And you can follow Eve on Twitter at Eve Rees. And you can find Australian Armour on the UQP website.
Coming up on the next episode,
one of my favourite articles about the protests, the headline is PS, which is public service, made to look like a lot of nongs. And that was in The Age.
We don't hear enough Australian vernacular in the press these days, do we?